Then he got an idea. An awful idea. The Grinch got a wonderful, awful idea.
Yes, I did. So I packed it up and brought it back to the crib. Just a little something to show you how we live. Everybody want it, but it ain't that serious.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Zoe Chase.
And I'm Robert Smith. It's February 10th, and that was the narrator from The Grinch Who Stole Christmas at the top of the show.
That's right. Today is one of those shows where we're going to give you some radio stories that haven't made it onto the podcast. Today's show is all about genius ideas.
Wonderfully awful ideas.
Awfully wonderful ideas. We'll take you to a van that's found a way around the bureaucracy of the Chinese government.
We'll also introduce you to a whole new way to eat an Oreo cookie. One woman's plan to make 1.3 billion people want to eat them.
A brilliant way a Greek computer scientist has to think about Greece's little debt problem.
All today after the Planet Money Indicator from our very own Jacob Goldstein.
Today's Planet Money Indicator, $558 billion. The U.S. trade deficit last year was $558 billion. That's according to figures the U.S. government released this morning. It was a good bit higher than it was the year before, but the trade deficit is still lower than it was way back before the financial crisis.
Still, though, a rising trade deficit means that we are buying more from the rest of the world than we are selling back to them. That seems like that is a bad thing, not good for the economy.
Yeah, I mean, on its face, a rising trade deficit, it's a drag on growth. It's also, you know, a continuation of these global imbalances we've been talking about forever, where we always run a trade deficit and China always runs a trade surplus. And this is generally considered to be an unsustainable thing. But that said, and, you know, contrary to sort of one of the big narratives out there, this rising trade deficit, it does not mean that the U.S. doesn't make anything anymore. It does not mean that nobody wants our stuff. In fact, these same numbers that came out today, they showed us that U.S. exports hit an all-time record high last year. If I could throw one more number at you, our exports were over $2 trillion last year.
Wait a minute. If we're sending more stuff to the rest of the world, that must mean, do the math quickly, we are buying even more stuff from around the world.
Exactly. Our exports went up. Our imports went up even faster. And, you know, that's partly because the economy is recovering. People are buying more stuff. So when you think of it this way, yes, fundamentally, rising trade deficit, drag on economic growth. But when you say, well, we're selling more stuff to the rest of the world, our economy is coming back, we're buying more stuff from the rest of the world, not ideal that the trade deficit's going up, but
not bad to see some churn and flow of goods.
I mean, yeah, certainly when you sort of work out the details, it doesn't sound quite so bad.
Thank you so much, Jacob.
Thanks.
On to the podcast, genius ideas. People who see a problem, come up with a way to solve it. Sometimes it works out brilliantly, and sometimes it just doesn't.
Our first story comes from something that actually happened to you, Zoe.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
So government bureaucracy, we've all dealt with it. We've all had to go to the DMV or whatever. But occasionally, some people see a bunch of red tape, and what they do is they figure out a way to make money off it.
And one day, Zoe comes back into the newsroom here at Planet Money, and she has this story about this genius who helped Zoe circumvent a complex bureaucracy, the Chinese government.
You've probably been to the DMV. Or to City Hall to get a copy of your birth certificate. And all this is annoying, but if you need a visa to go to China, it's a whole new level. Take the case of Adam Humphreys. He lives in New York City. He wanted to travel to China for a vacation. So he goes online, he fills out a long form, prints it all out, all these papers, shows up at the consulate, only to find out he's filled out the wrong form.
Can you help me? No. Can I print one off inside? No. Where's the nearest internet cafe? Well, it's basically where you got off the train, inside a Burger King.
The closest place to the consulate with internet access is a Burger King, half a mile away at the nearest subway stop. And you have to understand, the consulate is way out by something called the West Side Highway. It's on a windy, deserted corner, and if you're in New York City, this is the middle of nowhere.
And I saw inside the Burger King when I walked up there that every single one of their computers was dedicated to this particular Chinese PDF.
This is the moment when the young Adam Humphreys had his big idea. He called his buddy Steve.
And I was like, dude, I've got this amazing, like, this,
this is so fun. Very enthusiastic.
Adam and Steve Nelson rented a cargo van and drove it all the way out to the West Side Highway. They parked it right on the corner right in the line of vision of the people turned away from the consulate. So when the rejects filed out of the building, searching for a place to retype the form and print it out, they'd be greeted by...
Lucky Dragon, Mobile Visa Consultants, head office.
Currently based inside a Penske rental van.
This door right here? Okay.
Inside the van, it's as cozy as a college dorm room. There's an old couch in the back, a couple folding chairs, Christmas lights, bamboo mats. There are a couple Mac laptops and one ink printer. And it's full to bursting with customers, people who had the same problem Adam did. Jimmy Tong needs a passport for his wife.
At the embassy, they changed the form. I didn't know. Luckily, this guy was here to help.
Tong was sent over to the van by the security guards at the embassy door. That's how the guys get most of their customers.
I say, are you sure? Oh, sure. They have computer, they have printers, you know.
And what do you think of this van?
I didn't know. I mean, as long as it's not a robbery.
It's not a robbery.
I am stapling a passport photo to the front of a application for this gentleman's wife, and now I'm going to ask him for money.
Right, the money. Until they rented the van, Adam and Steve were freelance artists. They never thought about being entrepreneurs. So what do you charge for a service that you just made up? Well, they did have that one competitor. Remember, the Burger King.
I figured they were probably charging between 10 and 20 up there. We started at 10.
Start with an undercut, but they were overrun with customers, so they jacked the price up to 40. But then they lost too many people, so they dropped the price some and gave themselves a promotion.
Instead of letting people use our computers and print forms for themselves, it was we would help people put the forms together and print them and send them back inside.
And that's when you guys decided that you were, in fact, consultants.
Yes. Because you can consult anywhere, right? You can consult in a coffee shop. You can consult on the side of the highway.
Flat rate, $20 a person. For Buddhist monks, $15. Karma. They now take credit cards. They have a small business license. They hired 2 fluent Mandarin speakers. Expenses, printer ink, and occasional parking tickets. But they're still doing business on the side of a highway from a cargo van. They have to look especially legit. So they got matching bright blue fleeces, red beanies, and clipboards.
I think try to go for a Mac store kind of thing, you know? Like, everybody's comfortable in the Mac store, right? Everything's happening so efficiently in the Mac store.
They didn't want to broadcast exactly how much they make in a day because they were afraid other people might drive up with their printers in cargo vans. Before that happens, Adam and Steve want to expand, like into a retail space or just a bigger vehicle, like an RV.
That was my co-host, Zoe Chase. And Hello. Speaking of China, the next story also involves the biggest market in the world.
Right. Our next genius idea comes from you, Robert Smith.
Thanks.
When you look around America, you see a lot of products made in China. But in China, you don't actually see a lot of products made in America, as I know because I got my visa from a cargo van and headed over there a month ago. And Robert, you found this great story. You took one of the most American things I can think of and looked into how it was translated into something Chinese people would want to eat.
I hold in my hand a normal Oreo cookie.
Do you mean an American Oreo cookie?
Yeah, I guess I do. There was a day when all Oreos were American. But Lorna Davis works in a very different world.
I'm in Cookie Land.
And Cookie Land these days spans the globe. Davis was born in South Africa, ran the Oreo cookie brand in China, and is now calling from a biscuit conference in India. Which is why I have to be very specific about which kind of Oreo I'm holding. It is round.
Yes.
Black and white. And the taste? Well, this is where it gets complicated.
There are 135 components of an Oreo cookie. So there's bitterness, there's roastedness, burntness.
And then there's the white stuff. I just scraped some off with my bottom teeth.
And that is generally quite sweet and quite creamy.
And it has been for 100 years. So no one gave the recipe much thought when Kraft Foods introduced the Oreo cookie to China in the 1990s. Slap a Chinese label on there, and you're good to go.
Oh, 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 bright ideas and an Oreo cookie. It's a bright
Lorna Davis says Oreo did okay in China, but it wasn't huge. I know it seems crazy, but it wasn't until a decade later when Kraft started to really ask the Chinese consumer what they thought of the Oreo.
They said it's a little bit too sweet and it's a little bit too bitter.
And it turns out that if you didn't grow up with Oreos and all that emotional attachment, it's a weird tasting little thing. And this started a whole process in the Chinese division of Kraft of rethinking what the essence of an Oreo cookie really is. They changed the recipe and made the cookie more chocolatey, the cream less intensely sweet.
So they said, this is a better balance.
And then it started to sell. But the amazing thing was that once Davis's team began to tinker with the classic features of an Oreo, why not go all the way? Why does it have to be black and white?
I have here a green one. This is green tea?
Green tea ice cream.
Why does an Oreo even need to be round? Kraft sent me a rectangular Oreo about the length of my index finger. It's kind of difficult to twist open in the traditional manner.
I feel like I've never eaten an Oreo before in my life because it's falling all over the place.
But it dunks pretty well.
So it almost becomes a philosophical question. What is an Oreo if it isn't round, black, and crazy sweet? What is the essential Oreo-ness? What the Chinese team at Kraft figured out is that an Oreo is an experience. Their shorthand for it, twist, lick, and dunk. All their crazy new shapes and flavors of Oreo wouldn't work in China unless they could somehow build up that same emotional resonance that Americans feel about the cookie.
In the early days, people said there's no way that Chinese consumers will twist, lick, and dunk because that's a very strangely American habit.
But luckily for the Oreo team, the Chinese consumer was just starting to respond to American-style emotional advertising. Oreo launched a series of TV ads in China where cute children demonstrate to their parents and other adults how to eat an Oreo cookie in the American style. Here's a cute kid with basketball star Yao Ming getting instruction.
Yao Ming, you know how to eat Oreo? Of
course I know. First, you eat.
And to see a father humbly listening to his child explain this new ritual seemed to really connect with Chinese consumers.
Davis says they saw sales of Oreos double in China, then double again and again. It's now the best-selling cookie there. And there's a lesson.
Any foreign company that comes to China and says, oh, goody, goody, there's, you know, 1.5 billion people here and I only need 1% of that, and I've heard that from so many people, you're going to get into trouble because you have to understand the way the consumers operate.
And sometimes the results surprise you. That rectangular wafer Oreo is no longer just in China. You can now buy it in Canada and in Australia. And perhaps someday it will come home to the United States for the first time. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
You don't see just how wild the crowd is. You don't see just how fly my style is. I don't see why I need a stylist when I shot so much I can speak Italian.
Up next, a radio story about something we don't normally cover here at Planet Money, actually. The stock market. Everyone thinks they have a genius idea about gaming the stock market, but they don't think that for very long.
And in keeping with our theme of good ideas, of wonderfully awful ideas, here's a good idea gone bad. Adam Davidson tells us a story about a wildly popular economic indicator, one you might have heard of, but that actually tells you nothing about the economy.
You hear it so often, it's just the background noise of your day.
The Dow gained more than 156 points to close at 12,862.
So the Dow went on a run today, up 339.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average down fractionally about 17 points, finishing the day at 12,845.
That was Scott Pelley of CBS News, Brian Williams of NBC News, Maria Bartiromo of CNBC. They've all read the Dow's latest moves. I should say I've done it myself. We use the Dow to constantly check the temperature of the economy. A lot of people, maybe most people, don't even know what the Dow is. Well, it's just the stock price of 30 big American companies summed up and roughly averaged. That's it. And what does the daily movement of this number have to do with the lives of most Americans? Not much.
In 2011, well, we had days where it would go up several hundred points, and then the next day it would go down several hundred points. You can't really argue that the mood and outlook of the entire country was changing that rapidly.
This is John Prespo. He's one of the leading critics of the obsessive way the Dow is covered in the media, which is surprising because he's the editor and executive director of Dow Jones Indexes. We asked him how often he checks the Dow.
Not every day, and I'm one of the people responsible for it.
He says the Dow Jones average is great for a very specific purpose, to get a long-term sense of how the leading U.S. companies are doing. But its moment-by-moment or even day-by-day movements are pretty much meaningless. In fact, the guy truly responsible for it, Charles Dow, who created it in 1896, Prespa says Charles Dow didn't bother to comment on his own metric more than once a month. So what happened? How did we develop this 24-hour fixation on the Dow? Well, we panicked.
Panic of 1907.
Prespo points out that 1907 was a lot like now. A severe recession, banks were collapsing, everybody was trying to make sense of a disastrous economy. They wanted some handy metric that could tell you clearly, in an instant, what each day's news meant.
So they looked around and they found the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It took on a life of its own, shall we say.
Newspapers started referring to it. Then, during the Great Depression, it became a daily requirement. Now, of course, we can follow it every second of the day, which might satisfy that same need. We are still confused, and we want to know what the latest scary or hopeful economic news means. So we look around, and there's still this one thing available. It always has an answer for us, even if the answer doesn't actually mean anything.
Planet Money's very own Adam Davidson. And, you know, it's so strange to work here at Planet Money, and you go out and you talk to people, you tell them, oh, I work in an economics podcast, and they'll say, oh, yeah, you know, did you see how the markets did yesterday? How are they doing today? And I have to look at them and say, yeah, we're not that kind of podcast.
No idea. But, Robert, there is one thing that we do check, at least I check, every day.
This which is embarrassing.
I know, but I'm really into it. It's like a serial that never ends. The progress of Greece's debt situation.
And there are many reasons why Greece is in trouble right now. We've gone over them in the podcast. But a big part of it is they have a hard time collecting taxes there. People don't pay their taxes. They don't have the infrastructure to collect the taxes properly. And our own Hannah Jaffe Wald, when she traveled over to Greece recently, she found someone who actually came up with this brilliant idea, this brilliant way to fix this tax collection problem. In fact, I might even call it a genius idea. But the problem is no one listened to him.
Diomedis Spinelas has a mind map. He is a methodical computer science professor at Athens University, and he has a mind map on his laptop.
It tries to map how your mind works. It's like a tree.
Imagine a graphical outline of the tasks before you at any given time, or a flowchart with tasks, subtasks, subtasks. A mind map can, for instance, illustrate in a precise, clean manner the situation Greece finds itself in right now. Greece borrowed too much money. Click, and it branches out to Greece cannot pay back its debt. Click, two branches here. This fact threatens all Euro countries, and Greece is surviving off international bailouts. Click, Greece needs to increase revenues.
It was actually a no-brainer that I could help with that, or at least I thought I could help with that.
In 2009, Spinelas brought his methodical approach and his mind map to the Greek finance ministry. Solving the tax problem, he proposed, was not that difficult. Actually, with the help of information technology, it might even be kind of easy.
Because all the data was there, wherever you looked, you could see evidence of tax evasion, and I thought you just have to cross-correlate those two tables, and you will find the tax evaders, and then we can improve revenue collection.
For instance, say a corporation lists its officers and their compensation. Have the computer program check the officers' declared income. It should not be less than their compensation, but Spinelas's program found in many cases it was.
What we found is that some failed to declare that amount completely, and others missed a digit, so they declared 10 times less what they actually had to declare.
Spinelas's program found hundreds of thousands of cases of potential tax fraud.
Initially, we thought that's simple. We just post those results to the regional tax offices. They get the money, and we are all happy.
Greece has 300 regional tax offices. Spinelas shared his data with every one of them. And then he waited for the revenues to come flowing in. Nothing. A few weeks later, he sent it out again.
The results were disappearing in a black hole.
Most Greeks will tell you there is widespread corruption in the tax offices. Collectors take bribes. So an item was added to the mind map, management of regional tax offices. Spinelis wrote a small program that would extract each day's performance data from every single tax office.
How much revenue was collected through how many cases that were closed, the average number of cases, how many days it would need for all the cases to close if they were working at that rate, and also a list of tax offices that hadn't closed a single case on that day. And there are hundreds of offices each day that don't close a single case.
The program sent an email every single afternoon to the finance minister and every tax collection office reporting which offices did absolutely nothing that day.
And many days passed without anything happening.
It is around this point, 2 years in, that Spinelis had a disturbing thought. Fixing Greece's tax system and ultimately making the Greek economy work was not a matter of tweaking his computer programs. It was not an information problem. It was a culture problem. The people, the tax collectors, had to want to go after tax cheats. And if they didn't want to, they needed a boss who would make them want to.
This turnaround artist is not somebody we have within the tax collection agency.
At the end of 2011, Spinelis resigned from his government job. He's back to teaching. And Greece is still surviving off international bailouts.
That's our very own Hannah Jaffe Walt. And before we go today, we want to give you an update on our t-shirt project. So we've gotten a bunch of emails and tweets asking us, what's the deal? Are you guys still making t-shirts?
And, you know, people are very excited about this t-shirt, and they want to know, like, when can we buy it? We were going to trace the whole construction and design of a t-shirt around the world. Well, it turns out that making a t-shirt and documenting every part of the process is a lot harder than we thought.
But we're working on it.
But we have made some progress, and we will have an update for you soon on a future podcast.
In the meantime, you can email us, planetmoney@npr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Zoe Chase.
I'm Robert Smith. Thanks for listening.
They used to feel invisible. Now they know they're invincible. Champion.